Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a journalist of food, health, and the environment, reporting on public policy, science, and all the interconnections of all the different systems and factors in our world that impact health. We're used to talking about health in a personal vacuum, as if it's something that you or I could create for ourselves without any real specific reference to what's going on with the quality of our food, water, air, and earth, the viability of our communities, our society, or the ecological systems in balance or imbalance here on planet Earth. So every week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different thought leaders, scientists, experts, and authors about all different facets of what will impact us in our interconnected world. So on today's show, we're going to be talking about something very interesting. It's a bit of a departure for us, but I think it really speaks to the total context in a way that is vital to consider. We're going to be talking about economics and what next generation economics might look like. Very often when we look at all of the things that I cover on this show, whether it's the policies that regulate fracking to keep our water supply pure, or the economic forces that impinge on the healthcare system, or what's going on with our food supply, you know, with big agriculture using a lot of toxic ingredients, GMOs and other things that may threaten the future of the food supply, as opposed to our focus on personal health. All of these different systems impact health, but the underwriting value that's impacting all these systems is economics. So I'm so pleased to have on the show today an expert and author of a new book. His name is Saeed Dolabani. He's a leading expert in value systems approach to economics. His new book is called Memenomics. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. The Next Generation Economic System. He's worked very closely with Dr. Don Beck, who I'm sure many listeners may know, and it may be new to some of you, his wonderful work with spiral dynamics, which is a kind of holistic and living approach to structuring our value system and where we and our organizations and systems are kind of coming from, what's driving us, what is motivating us, and how we structure and deploy our values in our world. And that's what Spiral Dynamics is about. In this book, Saeed Dolabani applies spiral dynamics to economics. And it really kind of, instead of just kind of having a war between, well, you know, profit-driven corporatism, capitalism, more socialistic things, you know, that's been the kind of dialogue. Today we're going to open that up and look at a whole interesting analysis of how to view these things. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Saeed Dolabani.
Great. Thank you for having me on your show, Allison. It's nice to be with you.
Yes, it's great to have you here. So let me first make sure, am I pronouncing Memenomics correctly?
Memenomics. So
Memenomics.
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, good. And good. And how am I doing on your name? Is that correct?
Oh, you're doing my name perfectly. So
okay, good. All right. Okay. I always want to check. So I think some of our listeners may already be familiar with, or perhaps they've merely heard about spiral dynamics, and this is really foundational to your book and to your work. So can you kind of give our listeners a kind of introduction for those who are not familiar?
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. Spiral dynamics is a developmental model that was brought forth by, you mentioned his name earlier, Allison, by Dr. Don Beck, a developmental psychologist who met the creator of this framework, another developmental psychologist by the name Claire Graves, out of Union College in New York. And basically what spiral dynamics and the value systems approach, Graves called it value systems, the theory of human existence, what the value systems approach posits is that human nature, and I don't want to go too much into the theory, but it is really at the heart of what a whole system approach is all about. What Graves posited was that the human nature develops in progressively more complex or more sophisticated levels. And as we solve our problems at one level of existence, we move to a higher level of existence. And that movement usually takes place between what he called individualistic value systems to communal value systems. So we stopped being cavemen, and out of that we became tribes, and out of tribes we became emperors, and out of emperors we became nation states, and out of nation states we became corporate states. And our transition now is from corporate states to a place where we exist with egalitarian and humanitarian values, and out of that system in the future will emerge into what we call the second level of values, which is the integral systemics whole system view of the lower six level values. So it's quite a complex theory, but my work with Dr. Beck, and I've worked with him for a good part of the last decade, he's really one of the architects behind South Africa's transition from apartheid. What he'd done is he took Graves's work, and he was in Graves was in poor health when Beck met him, but he took his framework and left his academic tenure and went to South Africa to apply that framework to help the country transition from apartheid. And my work with him has been through the Center for Human Emergence in the Middle East, where we designed a potential program for the Palestinians to transition out of the toxicity that they've gotten used to with the help of everybody else, be it the Europeans or our Western the foreign policy, to help them out of that stagnation that they're in and help them build their own state in preparation to have a more fair settlement on a two-state solution. So this is real stuff. This is really applications of developmental psychology at the large scale. And so that is what I just explained, Allison, is the value systems and the spiral dynamics view of developmental psychology at the large scale. What my book does is it takes really a very thin slice of that value system sector called economics and applies the principles to it when there is, 20 or 30 different what we call general category memes that could be analyzed and reframed through the spiral dynamics framework.
Very interesting. That is totally fascinating. I have to just share for a minute. It's very interesting to me because I've been trying to do the same thing for health. I see that we Sure. focus on individual behaviors in health, and certainly our motivation for health comes, from our own being in a body, a living body, a living system. Our loved ones are the same, and yet, we're part of a larger system. Which is we're interactive with it. We can't subsist without it. We're completely co-arising with it. And yet we kind of have this a sense of health messaging that we could, do things individually. And, of course, there's much that we can do individually always. But, somehow we could ignore the larger context and the systems in which we operate, which seem much too big for us. And, kind of function, carve out a little territory and function therein. And of course we do the same thing with economics. I mean, the sense is we have to kind of buy into what is. We can't change the economic system. I think many people just feel it's enormous and so much bigger than them that all they can do is kind of batten down the hatches and go for an individualistic approach. Are we part of a changing economic system. Are there ways that in shifting our own values or behaviors that people can participate in a constructive change?
Yes, that's the good news, Allison. The great thing about our open capitalist system is that it's open to change. It's open to what I call disruptive innovation. We're seeing quite a bit of these values of disruption presenting themselves in a way that the current economic system can't even put its wrap its head around it. We're talking about the digital, the values of the digital age. We're talking about the knowledge economy that is bringing on, again, what I call disruptive innovation in ways that the capitalist system hasn't seen before. You know, all you need to do is take a look at the disruption that Google is creating for the well-venerated Madison Avenue, the advertising industry that has been in place for decades. What Google is creating is a model that is moving that stream of revenue away from, you know, an ad executive that takes home 10 to $15 million a year based on really on creating an ad campaign that goes in a newspaper that you don't know whether it's going to hit or miss. You know, what Google does is it makes those things more functional. It makes the entire approach to advertising, to revenue generating, a more functional system than what we have now. So the money that used to go to that executive goes now to 30, 40 different, tech-savvy engineers who can basically design more disruptive innovations. Look at, you know, the kind of disruption that Google is creating. You know, a driverless car, that reality is less than 5 years away. Google is behind that kind of technology. The disruptive nature of the values that Google has and other companies that are emerging into that, like Yahoo, like HP now, all those hold so much promise for what I call a distributed model of prosperity.
Hmm.
And we're just on the cusp of that. You know, we're just beginning to enter those values.
That's fascinating. I'd love to, hear more about what that will look like. But let's backtrack first before we go there and talk a little bit about where we're coming from in terms of the evolution of economics,
yeah,
according to spiral dynamics.
Yeah, well, what the spiral dynamics and the value systems framework, what the basic construct of that is that I mentioned Graves earlier, and Graves' framework posited that culture develops in stages. Well, throughout decades of research, he uncovered that there are a total of 8 levels of development that an individual, a group, or a culture can belong to. Those 8 levels, the first level is basically the survivalistic values. You don't get too many of those in modern advanced economies today, but you do get survival values. Cultures generally tend to downshift in order to survive, like what's happening in Syria today, for example. You know, the culture might have been at a higher level, but under war and under cultural stress, the culture downshifts in order to survive. So you get the survival values, and that's the first level. And in economics, that level really doesn't have much of an economic engine for generating revenue. Now the theory posits that as you solve the problems of existence at one level, you emerge into the next level. But at the same level, you're creating the problems of emergence into that system. So the next system after the survival values is the tribalistic values. And so this is the level of kinship, level of tribalistic warm family feeling. When a culture leaves a certain value system, it does not leave it behind. It includes it. The theory says that you transcend and include previous values. So the tribalistic value system contributes about 2 to 3% to the global economic output today. These are primarily the cultures that rely on agriculture, the still the traditional cultures that rely on low output production, basic trade. Again, it only accounts for about 2 to 3% of total global GDP. Now, you exit that second level system and you go into the third level system, and that is the system of heroic values. This mm-hmm. is where feudalism and egocentric values dominate the landscape. In culture, we've emerged into those values a long time ago, but in modern-day economics, a lot of the world is still in those values. Much of the countries that are part of the OPEC organization are in that values. Any culture that relies more than 50% of its GDP on extractive industries, on oil, on minerals, on anything that has to do with those kind of industries, is still in those value systems. Now, those contribute for about another 10 to 12% of global GDP. And then out of that system, we emerge into the fourth level system, which is the order-driven, the one true way of economic production. It's symbolized by central planning. The only dominant presence in that system today is China. China, everything is done for the one great way. They're the bravest experiment in a communist culture that is trying to become a capitalist mm-hmm. culture. And it's proving to be an interesting paradigm. But they account for about 15% of global GDP. Now, the next system, which is the fifth level system, is the one of strategic enterprise and the scientific method. This is the value system that wants to quantify everything we know about life. It is basically based in science, in math, in quantifying the entire human existence. This is where most of the first world countries' economies reside today, and really this accounts for the lion's share of today's global economic output. You probably get about 55 to 60% of today's global economic output from that value system. Now, what's happening today in Western economies is that we're transitioning out of this system that in its unhealthy expression. Okay, now, the theory says that each level has a healthy and unhealthy expression. Mm-hmm. And then as we tend to explore the extremes of every value system, like the U.S. has been doing with financial innovation and, the era really started with the Reagan administration of no government regulation, that corporations know what's best for the culture. As culture moves into the toxic aspects or the unhealthy aspects of that value system, they tax the system to the point where it either causes collapse or it causes emergence into the next level. And this is what we're in the middle of. We're in the middle of a paradigm shift. We're moving away from those strategic fifth level values to the sixth level system, which relies more on understanding each other, understanding humanity at a deeper level. Really, Allison, understanding the real purpose of capitalism, and what humanity is all about, what the purpose of capitalism is without so much regard to the bottom line. And this is the transition we're going through now. Now, the rest of the systems create an entirely new level of being, if you will. And my book designs an economic system coming from the seventh level of values. And we can talk a little bit about that if you'd like.
Yes, let's do that. So basically, just to kind of also anchor this a little bit for people, for example, some of the forces that we're seeing, like, you know, we're just a week or so out of a government shutdown and a battle over the debt ceiling, who should be paying for health care, whether we can afford that. It almost seems like there's some kind of, in other words, if we don't, on the one hand, if we don't navigate these things correctly, there can be breakdown, collapse, regression to earlier levels. This is what we've, you know, seen in the decline of civilizations in the past. We're kind of in a difficult situation here because, you know, the Earth is also at stake in terms of the climate and global ecologies and all the rest of it due to, you know, some of our many of our economic activities. And you also mentioned that, you know, as countries move toward extractive technologies, they tend to, you know, there tends to be a retrogression of some kind. And the battles here over the Keystone Pipeline, fracking, nuclear power, nuclear power is non-extractive, of course, you know, kind of center on some of these things. So, you know, are what we're looking at as a sort of right versus left or Democrat versus Republican kind of debate or divide that's shown up right at the core of American politics and policy, is that actually symptomatic of, you know, kind of choice points and differing paths forward or backward? And if so, can you kind of just, you know, use those examples and kind of give us a little bit of a picture of how you would think of that in terms of Memonomics?
Yeah, absolutely. Alison, what we're witnessing today are two different things. We're going through what I call the entropy phase of the enterprising strategic values, the fifth level system, or at least the financial innovation expression of that fifth level system of capitalism. We're going through the entropy phase of that. And what is happening is that it is coinciding with the rise of that sixth level system. I call that sixth level system, that egalitarian values started appearing in our economy in the early 90s with the advent of the internet, with you know, with the prime directive, if you will, of the internet is the democratization of information. You know, to democratize information is an egalitarian value, and it's really grabbing the world by storm. No one ever anticipated that the kind of change that we're seeing now, the kind of influences that these values will have on culture, are having such a profound and structural effect on how we express ourselves, how we inform ourselves. You know, I use the example of, if you were able to look back, you know, 25 years ago, there were maybe a total of three or four news agencies really shaping our values, telling us what the news is today. And we were able to make decisions based on how that information is delivered to us through a two-party system. Okay. Well, take that forward to where we are today, and, you know, anybody who's able to write a blog and sound somewhat intelligent, you know, anybody who can fund a satellite TV network, be it a businessman or someone who's concerned about the environment or someone who's concerned about a certain view, can have a TV show, can have the advancements that we have in technology, that overarching goal of democratization of information, has created such a diverse base from where people get their knowledge that the current system cannot manage it anymore. If there's a million websites and million blogs out there expressing different political opinions, there are a million different groups with different opinions. And that kind of complexity cannot be managed by a two-party system. So this is the kind of stress that you're seeing on the current system, which can't be managed by a two-party dynamic anymore. So that's really at the heart of all that's taken place. Now, as I said, it coincides with the collapse of the previous system that really started with the Reagan administration, that basically says the government is the enemy of business. We don't need government. And those values over a three-decade period really got embedded in the culture, so much so that any sign of any government intervention in anything, even providing, you know, basic human rights, if it costs a dollar, you know, the Republicans or whoever, you know, informs these fringe parties on both sides, you know, go up in arms. No, we need more. No, you can't finance this. And so the polarization keeps getting worse and worse because, number one, we have a dying belief system that thinks government should be out of everything. And so their way to express themselves, to sort of continue those values, is no to Obamacare. While the values that are rising are the ones who've really been impacted by the Reagan era values. How many more deregulated industries can you have? There's nothing left to deregulate. Government, Allison, became impotent by design. You know, those were the values of the Reagan era. Those were the individualistic values that I talked about earlier that are coming to an end, and we're emerging into a value system that's more communal. So, of course, there's going to be support for things like Obamacare. Of course, there's going to be support for anything that has to do with social programs. It's not because people are lazy. It's because, you know, the outsourcing of jobs, the shipping of our factories, the irresponsibility of corporations in pursuing these values have made people, you know, reliant on $8 an hour jobs, and those don't satisfy all the economic needs that we have in a culture that is based on free market values. So those are the kind of transitions that you're seeing now.
Before we go forward to the higher levels, I'm going to play devil's advocate with you for a moment.
Sure.
About the question about whether what we see on the internet truly represents it represents a democratization. I would agree with that in terms of the fact that, you know, everybody could put up a blog. But whether everybody pays attention to everybody's blog is another matter. And the same economic forces that are, you know, advertising, selling, promoting consumption, promoting extractive industries or other kinds of initiatives also still have access of influence both in traditional mainstream media and online as well. A gas company would be better able to sponsor a television program and a news program and maybe exclude something about their activities from the content than the other side would. I mean, there is some shift and changing that's going on with that. The other issue, because I've had previous guests on the show who talk specifically about journalism, is that most content, most news content, most news reportage, which was traditionally viewed as core to democracy, is really repurposed from newspapers, and yet there's a shrinking of the base for real investigative work. So there, you know, real investigative journalism. And, you know, that has been in decline, and so it's been replaced by kind of citizen journalism. But, you know, when journalists are not compensated and when everyone's kind of free to put up a blog, and I speak as a journalist, so I have vested interest here, one can't, for example, so readily go out into the field. One can't take on difficult topics and have editorial backup. One can't have the economic support for the work or the vocation or the activity. And, you know, so there may be a lot of people you know, screaming about a certain topic, but the center of well-informed debate around a topic, you know, may be weakened by the process you're describing. Am I misreading it? you know, what's your view of that?
Yeah, you're right on with that. What you just described are the we're in the middle of that paradigm shift. The old, you know, print journalism is dying, and what do you replace it with? And that is the question that will probably won't be answered in the next few years. It'll probably take a decade for it to take on a new form. I know this. I mean, I look at a newspaper that I grew up with in Boston, the Boston Globe. It was bought 20 years ago by the New York Times Corporation for $1 billion, you know, thinking that the future is going to be in print media. Or I don't know what their rational reasoning was. Maybe because they had money available for the asking and they decided to buy it. Well, it just got sold for $25 million to the owner of the Red Sox. You know, there's definitely something there about the loss in value in traditional journalism, and I don't think a newspaper can or any publication can survive based on reporting news that need to be read this afternoon. No more standing on the corner with extra, read all about it. Those days are gone. Those are being tweeted as they happen within a second to your cell phone. And that is the nature of the disruption that the knowledge economy is bringing to society. I think the future of journalism is going to be based more on research pieces, feature articles, investigative journalism, the way you described it, but it's not going to be, it can't be time sensitive, because anything that is time sensitive can be tweeted, can be, Facebook, you can get an alert from whichever newspaper you subscribe to. That type of journalism is gone for good. The remaining form of journalism is the one that really takes its time and do a feature story where, if you want to grab the New York Times on a Sunday, it's not something that's been reported about that you missed out on that week. It's something that has to deal with, maybe a new theory, a new concept that is not necessarily time sensitive. So those are the kind of disruptions that you're beginning to see, and the revenue generating model hasn't caught up with the technological change, and that's where the challenge lies. So, you get journalists who do feature articles that are based out of India, and they'll do it for $200. You can't replace that. I mean, it's becoming more of an economic model that's dying. I mean, and unfortunately, good journalism is being sidelined in the process. That's just the economic reality of the disruption that technology brings.
Yep. I think, that's a very interesting analysis, and that makes a lot of sense. Let's move on to what the two higher levels have, in the offing, and also I like the realism with which you say, well, this is in transition. It could be a couple of decades, and then what I'd also want us to get to is we're in a time when you say news can no longer be time sensitive. I get that, but many things in public policy are time sensitive. Votes happen. There's an opportunity to try to intervene in public policy that may or may not be effective because of, the kind of corruption of the political system. But, how do citizens is there a pathway for people to become? I guess you're saying the pathway is the tweet. If a vote is up, we'll find out about it and kind of move on from there. Because we also have this moving trajectory of climate change and environmental problems that we kind of need to, you know, we're under pressure, time-sensitive pressure to address. Maybe have a go at that, and then we'll talk about the coming systems.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Allison, the current political system cannot address these issues. You speak to any constitutional scholar, and the underlying theme today is that we are no longer a government of the people by the people. The government, be it the representative branch or the people who fund election campaigns to every executive branch, be it federal government or local government, are beholden to special interest and lobbyists. We are no longer a government of the people by the people, and that has to change. My people ask me for advice, if I can give listeners advice on what to invest in, and I say invest in the future of this country. Ask for your politicians to be transparent. Go find out what I describe in my book as smart government. Go find out what the values of a smart politician are. These are the values of what the millennial generation would be voting for, in the future. Those are the people that do things based on big picture, functional view of what the purpose of government is. You're beginning to see that with people in government like Elizabeth Warren.
Just thinking of her.
She's what I call a seventh level politician, and this is the seventh level system that we haven't talked about. We talked about egalitarian values and how we're emerging into that, and that we have to deal with that transition first before we emerge into the seventh level system. But that's the kind of political change that we need. We need politicians who are not beholden to the current system that has been hijacked by special interests and lobbyists. We need to return back to a political system that is beholden to the people, that cares about bringing companies that are going to provide jobs to the local community. Still 60% of our population only has high school degrees. Not everybody can be investment bankers. Not everybody can be stockbrokers. Not everybody embraces the values of white-collar work, the foundational stone of this post-industrial society is that we're all going to become white-collar technical workers. That is not the case, and someone has take on the social responsibility of providing that 60% of our culture jobs that pay well, jobs that revitalize that middle class that build this country.
That would be the seventh level, and describe that a little bit more, like define that a little bit more for people.
Sure. So Alvin, what we're transitioning through now is, as I said, from the fifth level system to the sixth level system. Now, the sixth level system is that egalitarian values. The problem with as important as that phase is, the egalitarian values that seek to deepen the understanding of what it is to be human, to deepen the understanding of what the role of capitalism is in culture. But once we get to that understanding, we really can't remain in those values too much longer. So the problem with that value system is that it sees everybody as equal. So we are all equal, but the environment affects how we emerge differently. So we need to transition to a higher level of consciousness that sees equality at the core of who we are, but also sees the games that the fifth level system plays, in manipulating and strategizing, and it also sees the dysfunction in the fourth level system. The fourth level system is the one of law and order, and it sees that it's diminished, and it looks to fix it. It looks to make government more responsive, more a government of a big picture that sees 20, 30 years down the line instead of the next re-election cycle. It also sees, the corrupt the practices of the third level system, and it also sees that it needs to take care of people and individuals who are still in that tribalistic kinship values, and helps them emerge along. So the seventh level system is the next tier of values. So the seventh and eighth level are the last two known levels of emergence in the model that I use in my book. We won't even talk about the eighth level because we really don't know what it looks like. We have an idea of what it looks like. We're talking about, global governance here. We're talking about, values of holistic interdependence. Things that really are, in the realm of inspiration for humanity more than they are actual life conditions. Culture probably won't get there for another 300 years or so. But the values that need to manifest now are the values of the seventh level system that seeks the functionality of all the lower systems. So what's happening is that we're transitioning from the fifth level system and mm-hmm. quickly going through that egalitarian phase of the sixth level system to a system that is more functional and distributed. So we're moving from, really a situation where you have a lot of the too big to fail institutions, mm-hmm. and be it government, be it corporations, be it any organization that, the values of the past have said, oh yeah, the bigger the better, the more efficient, the more cost effective, and so forth. We're moving from those kinds of structures to structures where failure occurs naturally without affecting the entire organism. So we're moving to a distributed intelligence model.
That's really fascinating. And just an example of the too big to fail model. That's on a the whole mega level of what's going on in our society. But even I've been experiencing having Time Warner Cable as an internet phone and cable provider. And, what happens is that we have these monopolies in providing service, of this kind, upon which we rely for this conversation, for communications, for the internet, for all the rest of it. And yet many of these services, from our cell phones to a whole range of others, are, kind of dominated by monopolistic businesses, where there isn't actually choice. Like, there's actually no way to, to get another service, and yet that provider is not really providing the service. They're not able to deal with the technical things because they're maximizing their own returns, and they're under no competitive pressure of any kind. So it's supposedly, the market will decide, but in fact, it's decided for. One's access to the internet and all of that, is going through this kind of gateway of this monopoly, and the same is true for a whole range of other things. That's just one example, really. Who cannot afford to purchase healthier foods or don't have that option in their neighborhood. So what kinds of things are going to, other than, complete breakdown, are there individual options for bypassing that and going to the next level? Or how do people participate? What do they do about this kind of too big to fail syndrome? And, I think there's always a hope or a dream of opting out of it, and yet that's not always possible, easy. Where do people look for other ways to participate?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it, Alison?
Mm-hmm.
This is a slow transition that we're going through. Mm-hmm. The things that I write about as a part of this, what I call the platform for functional capitalism, are really projections sort of on the trajectory based on the theoretical model that I follow, that is spiral dynamics and value systems.
Mm-hmm.
What has been happening with the disruption that the knowledge economy has been creating. The change that's coming is happening from two sources. The first source is really that disruptive nature of companies like Google, companies that are redefining the competitive fifth level system to one that is more of a distributed intelligence, a more of a functional type of intelligence that includes really anybody who's willing to participate. Part of what I see that is already happening are things in manufacturing. We're seeing manufacturing come back, and it's looking nothing like it did when it left this country. It is, it's coming back with this phenomenon called 3D printing, where, a 3D printer, basically a machine the size of a microwave, that could be placed in someone's garage, and with the purchase of some raw material, you can go to the internet, download a 3D dimension, computer-aided design software that will enable you to, do modular manufacturing in your own garage. You don't need a highly technical degree for that. So anybody who's willing to do that, you can supply, fasteners and little gadgets for your local hardware store and do it at your own time in your own garage. This is just a small example of the distributed prosperity models that the knowledge economy is creating. Digital manufacturing, modular manufacturing. It really, if you look at it and you look at the potential thinkers like Jeff Immelt, the GE CEO, he sees the new manufacturing employing as many as 16 million people. At its core, that could really change economic values in this country. It could change where things are manufactured, where warehouses, there would be less need for the traditional, dirty factories, if you will. This is a really high, precise manufacturing process. There won't be as much need for the warehousing needs that we had before. So these emerging models have the potential to redistribute capitalism as we know it. The model for something that is close to your heart, to what you talk about, the food industry. If there are models that allow people to do farming in urban centers. I wrote a blog about what to do with all the blight in Detroit. There is a local government that is a smart government that's designed from that seventh level, it will by eminent domain take over blocks at a time in Detroit. Take them over by eminent domain, knock them down, and start some kind of urban farming that will feed, the entire area. That is the appropriate use of land in areas that are experiencing urban decay. So the those kinds of models are emerging, and it's coming out of more of a need to really fill in what the previous system has left behind. $3 a pound for tomatoes is not a model that will fit the inner city poor, and the solution for that is to create those victory gardens that are popular on the East Coast, those type of community involved type of farming that will really supplement the new and emerging system.
I'm totally in favor of community gardens, and as a New York resident and one who has lived in both city and the country, I also know that the air and water quality you know, and indeed, I mean, those gardens won't be that healthy, for example, if there is a lot of traffic, if there is upstate fracking, which worsens the city's ozone levels and air quality and water. So there are these larger things that are done by these larger systems. And these small-scale solutions, you know, local solutions, which you're positing, and I've, you know, other people are positing, and I'm certainly in favor of, you know, local agriculture. In fact, I'm in favor of developing the upstate New York food shed to help supply the city, and you know, and really do the job right kind of thing. But you know, when you have these multinational companies, you know, trying to come in and turn the same agricultural regions into regions of extraction, you know, and without study of what the environmental or health impacts would be, and you know, the government, the governing body, the elected officials are under pressure to run campaigns and take their money. You know, you have these larger systemic forces overwhelming tiny efforts. What can people do about something like that, for example?
Well, sadly, Allison, that's a part of the political reality today. Mm-hmm. You know, the entire fracking industry was born out of a loophole in something called the nicknamed by the New York Times,
the Halliburton loophole. Yes,
mm-hmm. Loophole. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I talk about that in my book. You know, that was something that you know, Vice President Cheney was able to sneak into the law and make it into legislation and make it a law. You know, when half of Congress was gone on vacation, those are the kind of a closed system corporations that engage in extractive economies. They're heavily invested in that, you know, to them, the notion that they're losing market share spells death, and so they want to prolong their you know, closed corporation values for as long as they can. In a sense, we don't have, for example, a coherent energy policy. I mean, some third
right.
world countries have a coherent energy policy, but we don't. And the reason for that is because of embedded interests. So it all really boils down to you start with changing the current political system.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be new representatives in Congress. There has to be people like Elizabeth Warren, like Paul Volcker, you know, with mm-hmm. things that have with finance. You know, there has to be more people who are concerned with seeing what life looks like 20, 30 years down the line, maybe even two or three generations down the line. And unfortunately, we don't have that in Congress today. So the
but
change
we need
really,
it.
Absolutely, yes. So the change really starts with us understanding the values of the people that we elect, whether they're able to effect change, and whether we send them to a Congress or a place called Washington D.C. that is, you know, rife with.
I think we're coming up on the end of our show here, but you know, thank you. I think you really delineate the challenges and the choices very well, and thank you so much for being with me today on Connect the Dots. Saeed Dolabani, please check out Memonomics. You can Google it and find it online at Memonomics. It's on Wikipedia. It's also on your website, ecovestadvisors.org, where Saeed Dolabani has a blog. You can buy the book on Amazon. Highly recommended. Deepak Chopra has written incredible praise for this wonderful book. Hope you all go out and get it, listeners. Thank you so much for being with me today, and thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots, and we'll be back next week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.